The 2020 campaign. The 2020 presidential election is more than a year away, and already there have been two rounds of national debates, dozens of polls, endless prognosticating, and as of this morning, eight candidates who have dropped out. Here in Maine, there will be a Democratic primary in the U.S. Senate race. Four Democrats have already announced. One Republican has announced his candidacy in the 2nd District to challenge Jared Golden, and others are rumored to be entering the race soon. All of this as Maine prepares for a primary instead of a caucus and more ranked choice voting. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Which issues are top of mind for you? Do you find yourself more or less engaged than during elections past? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. 2020 promises to be quite the year when it comes to campaigns. Nationally, of course, we have the race for the White House. Here in Maine, two races are likely going to get a lot of national attention, the Senate race as well as the race for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Today, we're going to check in and see how these campaigns are shaping up. Joining me in the studio is Ron Schmidt. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from our Augusta studio, Maine Public's senior political correspondent, Mal Leary, and on the line with us, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. And I want to thank all of you for being here today. And we want to hear from you in the audience. How closely are you following the campaign already? Join in with your thoughts. And I want to say, I'm going to make a note before we go to questions. This is the first time Maine Calling has done a program on the 2020 campaign. We have been holding out, and this is number one of what I'm sure will be many. So, Gene, I want to start with you and the recent Des Moines Register poll that puts Elizabeth Warren ahead of Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, though the difference between Warren and Biden is well within the margin of error. I know it's really early, but do you read anything into this poll?
I do think that that poll is highly significant and very much a warning flag for the Biden campaign. Iowa voters, Democratic voters, are liberal by nature. Biden's last two presidential campaigns died in Iowa, so he has two tombstones there already. And so if I know there are some who think, well, you know, he'll catch up by South Carolina maybe. But we've seen candidates try to play that book before, and it doesn't work. So it is imperative that Biden have a good showing in Iowa, more so probably than any other candidate. Because if he loses the so-called front-runner status with the other kind of questions swirling around his campaign about durability and his age, I mean, a narrative could grow around him that could be very damaging in the other states as well.
Ron Schmidt, were you surprised to see those poll results?
I was a little surprised to see them. I think one of the things that complicates the Biden story right now is his campaign is focusing on the idea of experience, of the ability to cross political aisles in order to pull together legislation, his long career in politics. But another part of his story is that he has a strong base of support still among African Americans in the Democratic Party, which is why, as Gene suggested, South Carolina is going to be a race that he wants to try to draw our attention to. And I'm wondering what the result of him dropping out of the front could potentially be to that base of support. Is that base going to still stick with him? Or if he begins to lose that luster, will he lose that support as well?
Mal, Maine's Democratic primary isn't until March, but it will be a primary instead of a caucus, and voters will use ranked choice voting. Remind us of why we have a primary now instead of a caucus, and then tell us if you think this is going to make a difference in who Maine nominates or who Maine, you know, throws in the ring.
Well, the reality is we're having a primary because the Senate President, Troy Jackson, the state Senate President, was angry on the last hours of the special session and rammed the bill through. That's why we have a primary. To the point on the polling data and what's going on with Biden, we've seen polling become more and more difficult as people migrate to cell phones. And I would point out that at this time in 2008, Hillary Clinton was way ahead of some guy named Barack Obama that the pundits were saying, gee, this guy is a first-term senator and he's not going anywhere. So I put a large grain of salt on all of these polls this early on.
Tell me, though, let's go back to the question about Maine's primary and the primary being a ranked choice primary. A lot of people happy about that. They feel as though they don't have to vote for the person that they think will win. Well, people are saying, wow, I don't have to vote for the person I think might beat Trump. I can vote for the person who I really like in my heart. Do you think it will make a difference?
Well, it's going to make a difference because under ranked choice voting, somebody is going to win a majority of the vote because you keep throwing out the bottom votes that are cast until you get to that final number. We saw it work in the race for Congress last year in the 2nd Congressional District where you had two independents and they took just enough votes to keep the incumbent, Bruce Poliquin, from winning on the first ballot. Well, when they went to the second ballot and third, it seems that most of the voters for the two independents went instead to the Democrat, Jared Golden, and he is now our congressman. So ranked choice voting has the potential of increasing the support of whoever comes out in that final slot. Again, it's very complicated because the delegates aren't really selected by the primary. Only the number of delegates proportionate to what the ranked choice comes out at the end will then be elected at the Democratic State Convention. So it's in typical fashion of the Democrats. If they can make it more complicated, they will.
Uncharted territory. Gene, how closely are people in Washington watching Maine and ranked choice voting?
Oh, there. Maine is a big, buzzy topic down here in Washington, primarily because of the Senate race. Sue Collins has been underestimated over and over again, but she is in a really, as you all know better than I, she is facing a very tough reelection. She's done this before and survived. And I don't know that I'd necessarily bet against her. However, the energy among the Democrats is super, super high, and her poll numbers don't look really great. So the Republican Senatorial Committee is making no secret that protecting her is a top priority for them.
Okay, and I want to return to the topic of Senator Collins in just a minute. But first, going back to presidential politics, on the line with us now, Stephanie Kelly Romano, an associate professor and chair of the Department of Rhetoric, Film and Screen Studies at Bates College. Stephanie, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
Talking about the presidential candidates, you study how candidates and campaigns use rhetoric, how they get their messaging out. What is notable to you so far in this campaign?
This campaign is really interesting, and the last debate notably so, in the sense that obviously it's the primary, and so the Democrats need to kind of present somewhat of a united front. But at the same time, they need to make distinctions among themselves in order to win the nomination. So it's how do Democrats get through right now without imploding before the general election? And I think we saw after the second debate, after the last debate, kind of this reunification, right, where the Democrats were kind of like, oh, we all agree and we all get along, and this push to kind of get along, and the fact that Castro got kind of castigated by some of his fellow Democrats for going after Joe Biden in what was seen as kind of a nasty way.
What do you expect in the next upcoming October debate?
Oh, the October debate. I honestly don't know. I think there is going to be more distinction made in terms of Biden and the characterization of Biden as old school, old hat kind of establishment politics. I think that there might be some more negativity directed at Elizabeth Warren. She's somewhat escaped direct attack and confrontation thus far, but I think that might change as she gains momentum.
Could I ask a question, Stephanie?
Of course.
I was just talking with my students in one of my classes this morning about the use of the word corruption in the last debate and in the current political arguments. Mm-hmm. Do you expect to see more on that topic in next month's debate?
I would imagine so. I think that sometimes we latch onto things and they just kind of play themselves out. And I think corruption is one of those words that's ambiguous enough mm-hmm. that people can deploy it in a number of different ways, and it can be used, you know, in a really advantageous way as an accusation.
Indeed.
Well, Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us. That's Stephanie Kelly Romano, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies at Bates College. Okay, returning to the talk about the U.S. Senate race. Ron Schmidt, something that Mal and I were talking about a couple weeks ago after we interviewed Susan Collins on Maine Calling, is that for people in Maine, this election is about what Susan Collins has done for people in Maine. It may also be about the vote for the Trump tax cut and the Kavanaugh vote, but it's still about Susan Collins. On the national stage, though, this whether or not someone votes for Susan Collins is much about Mitch McConnell, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And about the idea of the Republicans maintaining control of the chamber. And I imagine that's going to be a very highly motivating factor, not just in how Maine Democrats vote, but in their likelihood to show up at the polls. If I could link that back just real quick to our previous discussion of ranked choice voting, one of the things that ranked choice voting has demonstrated in other states is that voters tell pollsters that they feel the process to be more legitimate, more open. That, too, could drive up participation rates. So I think a lot of this is going to come down to that.
Okay. And, Gene, give us an idea of some of the numbers we're talking about. Why is Senator Collins' race, why is the U.S. Senate race in Maine, and we should note that Senator Collins is not officially announced yet, but people are assuming that she is going to run again. Why is this race so much in the spotlight?
Well, because the control of the Senate chamber is somewhat up for grabs. It's a reach for the Democrats. This is not an easy thing for them to do. They need to win at least three seats to retake the majority of the Senate chamber. And probably they'd need four because they have their own very vulnerable incumbent down in Alabama. So it's a very fine line that they're walking. But one of the seats that they have to take is Maine. And so the entire control of the chamber is in Maine, in Colorado, in Alabama, and then maybe Arizona. So it's they may try to find another target, but those are the primary targets that we see right now.
Ron.
I was just thinking, too, in terms of the previous topic of rhetoric, that a difficulty for the Collins campaign, I think, is that one of her strengths as a candidate is what she's brought back to the state of Maine and the fact that she could wind up being chair of appropriations if she wins re-election. But there's a big question as to whether independent voters and even Republican voters are going to be open to an argument that rests upon experience in Washington, D.C., when the head of their party, the head of the Republican Party, keeps referring to D.C. as a swamp.
Mm. And Mal, let's talk about that, that both Susan Collins and Shelley Pingree could be positioned to be in very powerful seats, a year and 3 months from now.
That's very true. Shelley Pingree already sits on the House Appropriations Committee, chairs a subcommittee, and could move up to one of the more powerful subcommittees if the Democrats maintain control in the House. Senator Collins, because of these seniority rules in the Senate, is in line to become the new chair of appropriations if the Republicans maintain control. I would also point out that even if the Republicans don't maintain control and she's reelected, she would still be in a pretty powerful position as the ranking Democrat on the, ranking Republican in the Democrat-controlled Senate Appropriations Committee. Lots of power there. We've seen Collins use it, and we've seen Pingree use it in bringing back significant appropriations to the state for various projects. We just saw a bunch of bridges get funded, and guess who is the chair of the Transportation Subcommittee of Appropriations? That's right, Senator Collins.
Mm. Let's talk about Maine's second congressional district race. Jared Golden, first-term congressman, as Mal made note and let us explain to us again, won in the ranked choice system 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. Gene Cummings, how important is Maine's congressional district? Is the same kind of attention going to be focused on it as there was last time?
Well, there certainly will be, because the depending on where Pelosi takes her caucus, the Democrats could be at risk of losing their majority in the House. She has resisted this impeachment process because she feels as though it would backfire politically on them, and especially on the 22 or so Democrats who flipped Republican seats in districts that Trump won. And those are the most vulnerable House Democrats, and they are the people who created her majority. And so every move she has made is trying to protect as many of them as possible. And so there will be fight for control of the House, and that Senate, that House seat there in Maine is going to be one of the premier races.
And Mal, we think that there will probably be at least three people challenging for the Republican nomination in the 2nd District?
Well, we have Eric Brakey, who's a former state senator, already announced, and Governor LePage's former press secretary, Adrian Bennett, has been making the rounds of Republican county committee meetings trying to, you know, gin up some support for her. So I suspect we will have a primary on the Republican side. Jared Golden is already raising money and spending, as he told me, more time on the phone raising money than he would like, because he's got to. Historically, if you look at it, he's in his most vulnerable position in his first reelection attempt.
And we had an announcement today, another challenger to for the U.S. Senate for the Democrats. It looks like at least four in a primary there.
Yeah, that's going to be the interesting situation, because, of course, ranked choice voting applies to the primary. And the guy that jumped in today is John Tracy, who is a former major general in the Air Force and has some pretty impressive credentials from his military experience around the world. So he's in the race. He's making climate change, health care, sort of the two top issues that he talks about when I interviewed him earlier today. So I suspect that the primary is going to be quite interesting on the Democratic side. And there's always the possibility of a Republican jumping in to oppose Collins in the primary. There's always this threat from the right that we're going to go after her because, quote, she's not a real Republican, unquote.
Something that's interesting to me is that Jared Golden has stated out loud that he is not going to take a side in the U.S. Senate race. Ron, how unusual is that?
That's fairly unusual, especially in this day and age. I mean, Maine is peculiar in regards to a lot of its politics, and Maine voters are very open to arguments about experience and the ability to get things done and to deliver for constituents. So the idea that seasoned hands in a congressional delegation matters more than party. But there is still the question of what those seasoned hands are trying to achieve. And in many respects, the two parties are very opposed right now in their view of governing.
We are going to take a quick break. We'd love to have you join this conversation about the 2020 race. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
In one state, a Jim Crow-era election rule that's still in use is being challenged for discriminating against black voters.
The Mississippi Plan was created to take political power out of the hands of African Americans, and it was extremely effective.
I'm Ari Shapiro, undoing the Mississippi Plan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ta-Nehisi Coates. After writing three nonfiction books dealing with race and identity, and writing new Black Panther comics for Marvel, and writing a much-talked-about article about reparations, he's written his first novel. Set in slave times, it reimagines leaders of the Underground Railroad as having a magical power to help people out of slavery. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest on the race for the White House, as well as the race for Maine's Senate seat and 2nd Congressional District. In the studio with me, Ron Schmidt, an associate professor of political science at USM. His most recent book is Reading Politics with Machiavelli. Joining us from our Augusta studio is Maine Public's senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. And on the line with us, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Heath calling from Oxford. Hi, Heath. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, as a sort of newer voter in Maine, I did participate in last year, the recent presidential election. But I was wondering if you could sort of explain the difference to me between a primary and a caucus vote, and sort of what that means to me as a voter. Thank you.
This sounds like a question for a political science professor.
Fair enough. Hi, Heath. Thank you. Thank you for the question. You know, caucus used to mean a fairly small set of decision makers. Before the early 70s, a lot of nominating contests were decided by players, heads of various interest groups within political parties. But between the 68 and 72 elections, a group in the Democratic Party forwarded the idea that the grassroots of the party had to be more involved in picking nominees. You might remember that the 1968 Democratic Convention just blew up in Chicago. And the idea was that if rank-and-file Democrats felt more involved, that wouldn't happen. And so they pushed towards either primaries or general party caucuses. A primary is like any other election. You show up on election day and you cast your vote for a particular candidate, although it'll be different this year because of ranked choice voting. You cast your vote for a particular candidate, and they could be in there along with a member of the town council and various initiatives. A caucus is one where there are various places around the state where members of the parties meet to deliberate about who they like as a candidate, and there are a variety of different ballots taking place. It's more discussion-based. It can represent a somewhat narrower part of the electorate in most places because less people will go to a caucus than a primary. But Mainers really like showing up to talk about politics, and so our caucuses were usually pretty packed.
And a caucus can take many hours and a whole day sometimes.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah, Heath, thanks for your question. I'm sure many people have that question. We're going to go to Anne Marie calling from Portland. Hi, Anne Marie. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, go ahead.
I am going to throw a big wrench in everybody's discussion here, and I'm going to say that I'm probably not the only person who is so tired of listening to the same conversations every year and every 2 years and every 4 years. And I would love the idea of disruptivating our entire system so that we can figure out a way to actually do the best thing we can for humanity, for everybody who lives here, and have it stop being a football match.
So, Anne-Marie, do you have a suggestion? I think there are millions of people who feel like you do. Do you have a suggestion how to change it?
I don't. I literally was just listening to this, to the conversation, thinking it has to stop. I mean, somewhere there has to be a better way to look at the big picture. We have this big country, which is on a bigger planet, which is a bunch of people who really want to live really good lives. And there has to be a better way than having these little microcosmic groups of people who are battling for power, which literally leaves us nowhere.
All right.
Every 4 years, we go back and forth.
Gene, I'm throwing this one to you.
Okay. Well, I can understand her frustration. And, you know, Joe Biden will often talk about the bygone era when the Congress was capable of confronting big issues and working in a bipartisan way. And Senator Collins maintains that kind of practice as well, which whether Democrats or Republicans win control of the chamber, if the senator is reelected, she's going to be a player because she does that, because she engages on issue-based and not so much party-based. But, you know, clearly in the last couple of decades, a lot has changed. And I think we can go back to the early 90s and through the 80s, where things were becoming increasingly, the rhetoric becoming increasingly sharp, the tactics dirtier, and eventually the only way one side, you know, we can get something done is one side has to give the other party a win. And that's where they're frozen. They don't want to give each other, anybody, a win, because things are so close right now that small things could tip the scale about who gains control. And while it may seem like some petty little fight over control, whoever has control matters, because the parties stand for such different things. And so Nancy Pelosi knew she was putting her majority at risk when she pushed through Obamacare. But she wanted to get something big, historic, done. They got it done, and it has survived in some form. But then she immediately lost control of the chamber because of those who resented passage of that legislation. So they may seem like petty fights, but they're big policy priorities that are very different that are on the line.
Anne-Marie, thanks for your question, and thank you, Jean, for that. We have a tweet from Brenda. As a voter, I am deeply concerned with Speaker Gideon's campaign finance violations. Do you think acting as a straw donor, funneling corporate dollars into federal races, will impact the outcome of the primary? Mal, I'm going to turn this to you. Explain what Speaker Gideon has been accused of and where we stand with that.
What she did, it's not just an accusation, was that she used money improperly under the campaign finance laws and had to pay it back. The result is that ticked off some of the members of the Democratic Party. One of the things Democrats have always tried to do is improve accountability, transparency in elections, and they felt that the speaker should have been more on top of the issue. She basically blamed it on a consultant. And I have no doubt, having covered the speaker for several years, that she just turned it over to a consultant and expected that the accounting would be done properly, but it wasn't. So she's going to have to live with that among a certain group of Democrats. I would flip that around and say she's not the only one where we've seen these sort of problems over the years. In fact, this week, governor's inaugural committee has to go before the State Ethics Commission because they raised money after the deadline. That is a violation of the law, and the question is, what is the Ethics Commission going to do about it? So these sort of infractions happen all the time, and politicians pay the consequences. The big question that is always on my mind, that really depends on the election, is how much people are really looking at that versus the issues that affect them directly. Health care, taxes, a good road, high-speed internet. Things that affect their lives directly tends to be, at least from what I've seen, where people make their decisions based on those issues and not necessarily on some stupid infraction of law or something along those lines. Now, we won't bring the president into that, because then you've got a whole different level of things going on.
We'll go to Robert calling from Long Island. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. It's a very interesting discussion that you have here. I'll be short. I'm very disappointed in Susan Collins. I supported her for years. I'm a longtime Maine resident, 77 years old, retired economist. And I have to say that she has always sounded as though she is progressive, and then in the middle and at the last moment, she always votes for the Republican, even when she's by herself in the last vote. And she might spend 45 minutes discussing how she votes. but she always votes for the Republican. And that is, I believe, an example of why her financing comes mainly from PACs. It's predominantly from PACs, not from main people. I'm very disappointed, and I'm hoping that people have opened their eyes to her operations, that she always looks like she's going to be voting for the right thing, and at the last moment, she always votes the way Mitch McConnell wants her to vote, and it is just too much. Too much.
All right. A lot in there, Robert. Thank you for that call. Ron, this is the question, isn't it? How many Roberts are out there? How many people who voted for Susan Collins before will not be voting for her this time? Because there are a lot of people who never voted for her who are very angry. But how many are there really?
I have no idea. But I mean, that has to be the question that has Senator Collins worried. Her political message, her public profile, let's say, has been of someone who is a practical politician who takes care of constituents regardless of party. But parties and Mainers with their tendency towards the independent are open to that message. But parties aren't coincidental. They're not just donkeys and elephants. They are groups of interest groups that have come together to support candidates because they share basic interests. And people vote with party, especially in Congress, for very concrete reasons. Senator Collins votes outside of the Republican Party more than I think anyone else in the Senate does, but she votes with them more than 90% of the time. The fact that she's a moderate Republican says more about the Senate in 2019 than it does about Senator Collins. And I don't know to what degree that would disturb Mainers, but that is a fact that I'd like to see addressed more.
And Gene, I'm going to toss this to you, to Ron's point that Susan Collins can vote with Mitch McConnell most of the time and still be ranked the most moderate person in the Senate.
Well, that's true. And I mean, it's worth noting that there was at least one time it was only one vote. So statistically, it may not look so great, but her vote not to repeal Obamacare really mattered. And that vote was clearly against party and with others in her constituency, I suppose, in mind. So, you know, those numbers tell you a lot, that she does vote with her Republican colleagues more often than not. But a couple aberrations here and there, and something that she's doing something that looks a lot bigger than the stat.
Go to Steve calling from Millinocket. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, so I'm a town councilor here. And I really appreciated one of the questions that an earlier caller raised of how do we disrupt the system. In my opinion, I think there's two main issues. One is how heavily tied people's identities seem to be to political parties, which, in my opinion, are getting much more extreme. And that, you know, obviously has its consequences. And two, the lack of people that show up. I've been to so many different local events put on by municipalities, and it just always astounds me how few people actually engage. I think the local government is the best way for people to actually bring about change for many reasons. So I'll just leave that to you off the air. Thank you.
Steve, I really appreciate that call. Kind of your message is, you know, before you complain, maybe try to get in there and make a difference. I guess we've lost Steve, but thoughts, Ron?
I think that's a very good point. If I could kind of wax sentimental for a second, one of the things that I like about living in Maine, and I grew up in California, is our voter participation rates. And yet, despite that fact, what Steve is saying is true. I've been to a couple of town meetings where no one has shown up. I've also been to town meetings that are completely packed. I think ranked choice voting fits into this as well. Insofar as we give voters reason to believe that the system is legitimate or that the system hears their voices, they're more likely to participate. And that in and of itself makes the system work in a way that is more legitimate, hopefully at a time when even the president is calling the integrity of our election systems into question. Maine might, again, have the possibility of leading the nation.
An email from Henry. You can already see big money coming into our state this election cycle with the Senate race and Democratic primary. Is it unfair to voters? when a major party committee like the DSCC selects their candidate, Sarah Gideon, so early that it shapes the voters' opinion before they really have one themselves. Ron, I'm going to throw that back to you. What do you think about the early support for Sarah Gideon from national groups?
I very much understand Henry's point and the degree to which it can feel really frustrating for constituents who feel like their voice is dimmed by outside voices. But Maine, as Gene pointed out before, Maine is very buzzy at the moment. We matter on a national level. And we have to expect national parts of political parties to pay more attention to us. And with that attention comes investment.
I'd also like to just chime in here. Just because the national party has thrown its weight behind a candidate is not necessarily, doesn't have to be a fait accompli. And what we saw last year in Democratic primaries for the House across the country is candidates just kept getting into them. So you'd have these great big rosters of candidates, which out in California was particularly worrisome because of their voting pattern, where the top two out of the primary, no matter what party, go to the general. So the Democratic Party, you know, had this great fear that if we have 10 candidates in the primary and two Republicans, you know, that the two Republicans could slip through because the 10 Democrats are going to divide up all their vote. So they had to go out there and remove some of their own candidates because some of the candidates who began surging were outsiders and activists. And the other irony here is that sometimes the Democratic House Committee had to withdraw one of their own preordained candidates was because those were the only candidates that would even listen to them. If the Democratic House Committee tried to call that, you know, the activist who was surging that they never supported anyway, they're not, that candidate's not even going to take their call. So, you know, there are ways where the establishment can be beat. So, you know, don't give up entirely.
We are going to take another quick break. If you'd like to talk about politics, the campaign 2020, call 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Subaru in Auburn, featuring the 2019 Crosstrek Hybrid, all-wheel drive and plug-in hybrid in one. EvergreenSubaru.com. And Maine's Pumpkin Trail, 40 miles of coastline featuring pumpkin boats, parades, shopping, gardens, and more. MainePumpkinTrail.com.
Can focusing on science and technology transform the way Americans think about the economy and the future of the nation's working class?
They lost their manufacturing jobs. Nothing has come to replace it. This is an additional dimension about which people differ, and it feeds into some of our disagreements.
I'm John Donvan. Join me in conversation with former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson on the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Ken Burns' newest documentary, Country Music, continues tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television with a focus on 1973 to 1983. You'll see and hear a vibrant era in country music, with Dolly Parton finding mainstream success, Hank Williams Jr. and Roseanne Cash emerging from their famous father's shadows, and Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings launching the outlaw movement. That's Ken Burns' Country Music tonight at 8. You'll find the full schedule at mainpublic.org or in your Experience magazine.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest election news, both here in Maine and nationally. My guest today, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at USM, Mal Leary, Maine Public's senior political correspondent, and on the line with us, Gene Cummings, deputy Washington bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Kenneth. I would love to see a national primary day holiday. Everybody would have the day off and no excuses for not voting. I also believe on a national primary day, all states would vote on that day. It has never made any sense to me that one state would go before others. After those few states vote, we have Super Tuesday, etc. The states in the far west probably feel like, why bother? Same goes for Dixville Notch. Why should they vote before everyone else? It doesn't make any sense. I also favor using the popular vote in presidential elections. Ron, I knew you'd love this one.
I love the idea of a holiday on Election Day, especially because Election Days are Tuesdays. And so it probably wouldn't just morph into a 3-day weekend that would drive down participation, which it might if it was on a Monday. The national primary day is a little bit more complicated, I think. The purpose of the primary was to attempt in some way to empower grassroots voters. The Democrats did it first. After Watergate, Republican rank-and-file voters basically demanded that they get a chance to do that, too. And the ability of local organization and local campaigns to work with national campaigns could be affected if everything came due on one day.
All right. We have a tweet. Will Representative Golden ever be forced to come out in favor of impeachment? Could the information provided by the whistleblower cause him trouble if he is not on the side of impeachment when it's released? For the first part of that, Mal, I'm going to turn to you. And for the second half, Gene. But Mal, have you talked to Representative Jared Golden about impeachment?
Several times. He is very concerned about the issue because he looks at the political ramifications of an impeachment, knowing full well that a Republican-controlled Senate will never convict. So you have this process that's going to put the country through considerable turmoil to basically get a grand jury indictment, to draw that analogy, charging the president with wrongdoing. But then it goes to the trial in the Senate, and it's pretty clear to everyone I've talked to, and Gene's closer to it than I am, that, you know, that Republican caucus is going to stay solid and they will not vote to remove their president. So that's one of the factors that Jared has talked about. And he just thinks there are issues more important, that the voters will have a chance to vote out President Trump. And he's more concerned about what's going on with climate change, what's going on with getting lead out of school buildings and out of homes throughout the United States. He's got a set of issues that he is focused on that he thinks is more important. And that's where he wants to go. And he really kind of looks upon the impeachment thing as a political sideshow that he doesn't want to get involved with.
And Gene, the second part of that question, and I think this probably applies to more than Jared Golden, but all of those representatives in swing districts or purple states, is could the information provided by the whistleblower cause these people trouble if they're viewed by the voters as being on the wrong side?
Well, it could be. We should keep in mind that the Watergate process was long. That didn't happen quickly, and Nixon was reelected in the middle of it. And what really brought that to its crescendo was the discovery of the tapes. So Pelosi's process has been plodding along, and maybe you find a tape, you know, or some equivalent thereof, and then she would consider action. So the question now is this whistleblower report, and based on our reporting, was the action by the president in withholding aid to Ukraine and pressuring them to investigate a U.S. citizen and former vice president so he could get dirt for his reelection, is that the equivalent of the tape? It is a constitutional crisis as they view it here in Washington. The experts that I have heard all believe that it's not in question whether Congress has a right to see that report. They do. And, you know, it may ultimately be litigated, of course. But here's the risk. Here's the other risk. Everybody thought, oh, when the Mueller report comes down, you know, that's, it's going to be curtains at the White House. Well, guess what? Mueller pulled his punch. It was bad, yes, but it wasn't curtains at the White House. They were doing jigs. So what happens if we get a public release of this whistleblower report and it's not what we all think it is? What if it's less? So there are great risks here.
Yeah, if I could, one of the things that gave the Watergate tapes power was not just the revelation of crime, but the revelation of how different the president's private voice was from his public. That he,
yes, indeed,
that he was so vulgar and vile in his communications in the Oval Office. And what the tape helped to do was to basically put pressure on Republicans, on members of his own party, to come out against him. In part, I think the Mueller report lacked that kind of punch because it revealed similar things. But President Trump has never pretended to not be that person. And so that was less shocking. The story, the work that the Journal did last weekend was tremendous and I think has probably changed the ground under the feet of Democrats in the House. I think that it sets up a situation in which Democrats now feel a sense that they have to act. There was a letter in the op-ed section of the Post yesterday signed by freshman Democrats in purple, at least, districts who have all served in the military or in the defense establishment, who all said that they had resisted impeachment before, but that now they see it as a national duty. I think that's going to change the calculus.
We'll go to Nick, who's calling from Kittery Point. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to the caller who was frustrated with the political system and the slow pace of change. And I was just going to remind her that change is difficult because there are people who see a better future, but there are also a lot of people who are very comfortable or at least satisfied with the way things are. And there's a constant struggle between change and keeping things the same. And so the political process is slow, but if you look over a long period of history, we've made a lot of progress. There are a lot more people who are represented, and it's difficult to change things that are entrenched, but it does happen over time. And there's a really good, like, quick way to do all that because there are people on all sides of issues.
Nick, thanks for your call. Ron, you could invite him to class.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go to Paula, who's calling in from Portland. Hi, Paula. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Shout out to my colleague, Ron. I'm also a professor at USM in the School of Social Work.
Hi, Paula.
Hi, how you doing? I guess I'm calling because I'm feeling a little bit frustrated around the narrative that's been constructed, and I realize this is also part of the more corporate media, around policies like Medicare for All, elimination of student debt, $15 an hour, some of these policies which are being portrayed as radical and socialist and far left, when in fact they're not. And it's being perpetuated by, you know, from MSNBC to Fox to other, you know, in the media, when Medicare for All and these proposals are not radical. In fact, having spent a great deal of time in Europe, they're quite mainstream. And I think that's what frustrates me, is that there is sort of a ginning up of these social policies, these policies that are not radical, but we're being pitted against each other within the Democratic Party that, oh, they're not electable, even though there's high favorability for these policies.
Paula, thank you so much. But Jean, do you have thoughts about what Paula said?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually fairly complicated. The candidates themselves are describing those particular proposals as game changers, as big, broad ideas. So they themselves are touting them as radical change. And so that's one reason that I think you see the description by some, you know, in the media saying, you know, this person wants to radically change the healthcare system. In part, it's because that's what Bernie says he wants to do. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, talks about big ideas. And that was one of her criticisms although oblique, of Biden. Is that, you know, why bother going through all of this and running for president and getting yourself elected to do incremental change? So that's one reason that I think you see that kind of language around some of these ideas. And but you also mentioned that there's a lot of support for those. I'll speak to Medicare for All and free college. There is in the Democratic Party. There is not with the general public. If you take a look at our latest WSJ NBC poll that we just wrote in the last week, we took these issues to into the poll, and we asked, you know, where the Democrats primary likely Democratic primary voters are, and then regular, you know, just likely voters. And they're not popular with the public at large. So that is the risk that is that Warren and Sanders and others are taking. And that is the calculus that is prompting Biden to go a different way. But if you take a look at that poll, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, Paula, thank you for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in the tiny bit of time we have left. Joe on Facebook says, please give a nod to the Green Party. Rules are so stacked against any party other than the big RND. As it is, the two big parties dictate the political conversation. Perhaps we should encourage more than two major parties sponsored by big and sometimes dark money. Ron?
Our election system is all about who wins on election day. Again, ranked choice voting might change that calculus. But as it stands now in most of our elections, what you need to win on election day is more votes than the other team. And that logic does push a couple of big parties.
All right. Well, thank you all. Such great guests here today. The voice you just heard, Ron Schmidt, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine, Gene Cummings, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal, and Mal Leary, Maine Public's Senior Political Correspondent. Gene, we'll post that poll on our webpage and Facebook page. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and a lot more information at mainecalling.org. Today's show was produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.